right, so my name is Allison Reiheld, and some of you know me already. The listing in church this week said today's sermon was going to be about atheism and transformation. That was an old idea, the new idea, because it has transformed. That I'm going to talk about the peril and promise of transformation. So a lot of the songs we had earlier were sort of, you know, uplifting views of transformation. Nina Simone's Feeling Good, right? It's a new dawn, it's a new day, I'm feeling good. That doesn't always happen. So I'm going to talk about some of the downsides of transformation as well and sort of how we can think through this. Now, I'm going to see if I can keep this on time. All right. So in our culture, we have a lot of classic narratives of becoming that are not only about redemption, but also about corruption and brokenness. So think of Kafka's short story, Metamorphosis, in the first line of which is, Gregor Samsa awoke one morning to find himself transformed in his bed into an enormous insect, right? The poet Rumi, however, does give this more uplifting version, saying that sorrow clears the way for joy. It waters the fruit, or the trees that have the fruit, which is joy. Parenting is a transformation that a lot of us have gone through. Not all of us have, not all of us should. You don't have to have a good life, but it is a transformation, becoming a parent. And dominant cultural narratives about this paint it as the most wonderful thing, right? A radical change in identity for the better. So wonderful is it supposed to be, so suffused with the golden glow of maternal love are we supposed to be when we become mothers or, you know, fathers with this nurturing, protective sense, right? That those who do not feel this, or who come to resent their children, or even those who have priorities in addition to their children, are all too likely to be condemned. We do not even wish to hear counter-narratives about this particular transformation. Indeed, when women we admire remain child-free, we are all too likely to let slip, but you would have made such a good mother. Or, I wish people like you would have children. We attempt to persuade others to undertake this transformation, which is an enormous transformation. Think also of prison narratives and the film The Shawshank Redemption from a few decades ago, right? Often there are tales of prison as a redemptive experience which strips away all that is not the real you and allows you to finally find yourself and reform, right? And yet prison is a life where you are surrounded by people who struggle, where you are in close contact with them, and with few outlets for your own actual expressions. It's often deliberately a place of dehumanization. And for all that Martin Luther King could write his letter from a Birmingham jail, or Nelson Mandela could remain committed to political liberty while he was imprisoned on Robben Island, the transformations of prison are often not redemptive at all. They make it harder sometimes to be a person who is different than you were. And even if they are redemptive, upon release, ex-convicts are rarely allowed by our society to start over. That's why there's this Ban the Box campaign. If you haven't heard of it, you might look it up. It's an attempt to make sure that job applications no longer have a box to check where you've been convicted or arrested for a felony, so that at least you can make a first impression that doesn't include that. So transformation actually is neutral, despite the way that we often have the image of the butterfly, right? You're in your chrysalis, you become something else, you're the ugly duckling, and it turns out you were a swan all along, right? But transformation is actually neutral. It has both peril and promise. The real issue is, what do we become? Is that person one with a life in which human flourishing is still possible? Does it matter whether transformation is thrust upon us or chosen? Is the nature of the transformation even within our power to know or anticipate? The narratives I've given already suggest that we already have a cultural sense that the answer to these questions are ambiguous at best. I'm not going to give you clear answers. I'm going to give you more questions. There's a famous essay by a guy named Bertrand Russell in which he says, what is philosophy? It's asking more questions. Doctors don't like bioethicists, which is my main thing, because we come in and we make things that seem black and white, gray, and they're like, just stop. It was really clear before you came into the room, right? So I'm gonna make things very confusing, potentially. That's my job. So Some of these questions I'm going to give you are actually tools for finding your own answers. It wouldn't really be appropriate for me to tell you what you should answer, I think. But it might be appropriate for me to tell you what my answer is. However, I'm not even going to do that. As Krishnamurti would have us do, you're going to have to find the answers yourself. And by coming up with these some more questions, we may find better answers. Right? So let us consider chosen transformations. And then we'll think about unchosen ones that are thrust upon us. Here are a couple examples of transformations we often choose or choose not to undertake. Becoming a parent in the time and manner of your own choosing. Seeking a new job when you already have one. It would be unchosen if you were fired, for instance, right? But we're talking about chosen ones now. Moving to a new town or even a new country. Marriage or long-term partnership and cohabitation. Becoming engaged in a community of choice. An elective surgery that would substantially change your body. Taking a medication for mental illness. Now, some of these can be thrust upon us by fate, by the failure of our preparations, no matter how careful, contraception, by violence, by circumstance, right? But for now, we're just going to consider the chosen versions of these. Philosopher Laurie Paul considers what she calls transformative experiences and suggests that many of them present what philosophers call epistemic challenges. I do teach, so I'm going to tell you what those words mean. Epistemology in philosophy is the study of knowledge. It includes what it is to say that we know something as opposed to just believing it. What is truth, capital T or little t, or however you want to see that. Who is seen as an authoritative knower and why some people have their testimony taken more seriously than others based on race or class or gender, etc. Why do we find some people more believable than others than for reasons that seem quite arbitrary? These are all epistemic questions in philosophy. And Laurie Paul suggests there's a huge knowledge problem, an epistemic problem, with choosing to undergo a transformative experience. Namely, if it is truly transformative, we may be totally unable to know what we're getting into before it happens, right? We don't know what's on the other side of that choice. We may not be able to know how, whether, and to what degree we will be transformed. You could ask people, but as we're going to see, even that is problematic, right? Now, you may know enough about philosophy to know that philosophers love thought experiments. A thought experiment is a hypothetical scenario, sometimes quite bizarre, that aims to highlight the central problem the philosopher is considering. For instance, how do you know that right now you are not just a brain in a vat hooked up to a computer that's giving you sensory inputs? How do you know that you're really here? Right. In the classic example from Descartes, how do you know that there isn't a little devil on your shoulder deceiving you at every moment about the truth and reality, right? So philosophers like these because they allow you to sort of alter reality in such a way that you get to pay attention to what the philosopher making the experiment thinks is the most important thing about it, all right? So for Descartes, his biggest problem was, how do I know anything is true and that I'm not being deceived? Right? How skeptical should I be about my experiences? So of course he picks the devil on your shoulder deceiving you, right? Because that makes sense at the time he lives. The brain in the vat hooked up to a computer thing would make no sense to him. That's clearly a modern example, right? Okay. So Laurie Paul gives a thought experiment that's a little odd, and I needed to tell you about thought experiments so that when you hear this, you won't be like, that's so weird, I can't think about it, okay? So her thought experiment runs like this. This is from her 2014 book, Transformative Experience. And I find this really kind of engaging, and maybe you will too. It's sort of fun to think through. Let's pretend that modern day vampires don't drink the blood of humans. Okay. Already it's weird, right? They're vegetarian vampires, which means they only drink the blood of humanely farmed animals. You have a one-time-only chance to become a modern-day vampire. You think, this is a pretty amazing opportunity. Do I want to gain immortality, amazing speed, strength, and power? But do I want to become undead, an immortal monster, and have to drink blood, however humanely farmed the source is? It's a tough call, you think. Then you go around asking people for their advice, and you discover that all of your friends and family members have already become vampires. They tell you, it is amazing. It is the best thing ever. It is absolutely fabulous. It's incredible. And they run out of superlatives, right? You get these new sensory capacities. You should definitely become a vampire. And then they say, then you say, can you tell me a little more about it? And they say, you have to become a vampire to know what it's like. You can't, as a mere human, understand what it's like to become a vampire just by hearing me talk about it. Until you're a vampire, you're just not going to know what it's going to be like. So they're telling you, you can't know what the choice entails, right? Okay, well, this is vampirism, so this is not very realistic for us, right? In this scenario, you neither know what you will become precisely, nor do you know whether the experience itself will make you into the kind of person who is convinced they made the right choice. In my experience, this is actually a startlingly good analogy for the choices I mentioned earlier, becoming a parent in the time and manner of your own choosing. You don't know necessarily what it's going to be like to parent, and you don't know if becoming a parent will make you into a person who will say, I was right to become a parent, and everyone else should too, right? Seeking a new job when you already have one, is there something about that process that turns you into a person who becomes committed to the fact that it was the right decision to do that? Moving to a new town or even a new country, marriage or long-term partnership and cohabitation, becoming engaged in a community of choice, an elective surgery that would substantially change our bodies, are these the kinds of experiences that we not only can't know about ahead of time in terms of their full content, but where we could expect that they would probably turn us into the kind of people who would say we'd made the right decision? And then, how do we get our information about that if we can't sort of trust the judgments of people who've already undergone it because it has made them want to have undergone it? So in that sense, while the vampirism example is like totally weird, I grant that, right? It's also a kind of nice analogy that lets you step outside of your own transformative experiences and think about this one that's abstracted from reality. So some of these changes might be wonderful. Some might be terrible, these real-life changes, but many cannot be understood in advance, perhaps, and some can change us so much that we come to be the kinds of people who cannot possibly regret that change. This is, I think, an aspect of transformations we don't think about enough, and it has implications both terrible and wonderful. Terrible because then we seem to not have the ability to make informed choices, right? And we might be making a choice that we ought to regret, but we come to be the kind of person where we don't. Wonderful, because it means that we can adapt to almost anything, right? Almost anything. So let us for a moment consider the classic narrative of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. How many people have heard of this? Show of hands. Okay. Possibly many of you have seen this in films where they pick out different parts of the novel. So I'm going to give you an excerpt from the actual novel. Just as a refresher, Dr. Jekyll thought perhaps he had a cure that would help all mankind, that would be able to separate the good from the bad, highlight our angelic natures, and eliminate our less desirable natures, right? Out of frustration and virtue, he chose to test it on himself before anyone else, and while it was indeed successful in separating the good from the bad, it did not have the anticipated result. Indeed, the treatment altered him at a fundamental level, including in ways that made him think the alteration to be one that he did not wish to undo. So when Dr. Jekyll becomes Mr. Hyde is like, finally, I am my true self. Right. So here's a brief passage illustrating the transformation. This is kind of fun if you like science fiction stuff that's slightly horrific, but not super horrific. The most racking pangs succeeded. A grinding in the bones, deadly nausea, and a horror of the spirit that cannot be exceeded at the hour of birth or death. Then these agonies began swiftly to subside, and I came to myself as if out of a great sickness. There was something strange in my sensations, something indescribably sweet. I felt younger, lighter, happier in the body. Within, I was conscious of a heady recklessness, a current of disordered sensual images running like a mill race in my fancy. A solution of the bonds of obligation, an unknown but innocent freedom of the soul from morality, it turns out. I knew myself at the first breath of this new life to be more wicked, tenfold more wicked, sold a slave to my original evil, and the thought in that moment braced and delighted me like wine. All right. So here's a transformation that's fundamental. He didn't know what he was getting into ahead of time. And after it happens, the new him is like, yes, finally, right? I'm free from all the trappings of society. I'm Victorian society, right? And so this is really restrictive society. You could see how somebody might be like, finally, right? But it goes too far, right? What would it mean to undergo a transformation so extreme, to not know in advance for sure what we are choosing, and to suspect it possible that we would become a person who loved the transformation and insisted on maintaining it? What does this even do to the concept of choice and chosen transformations? We didn't go as far as vampirism or Jekyll and Hyde. Let's consider unchosen transformations, like maybe addiction. Right? We can choose other kinds of transformations, like education, or religious conversion, or the effective use of medications that alter mental illnesses. All of these are characterized to at least some degree by the fact that on the other side of the transformative experience, we become convinced the transformation is wondrous, correct, and enlightened. Even addiction, for a time, leads many people to feel wonderful, depending on what the thing in question is, right? With all of these, we may eventually come to doubt that the transformation was a good idea, but there is something about the transformation that will transform our ability to reflect on the transformation. Just like a totally philosophical thing to say. Use the same word like three times in a sentence, right? But you get the idea. How many people have an epiphany as a result of education? Now I see the interconnected nature of oppression in society, and then later wish to have it undone. Anyone? Maybe. But a lot of us think, oh, now we get it, right? How many people discover the highs of heroin and cocaine and wish it undone? There's a reason that the psychology of addiction requires that the individual themselves be committed to the idea that they need to stop and that they need to hit rock bottom to do so. Is becoming a parent a similar situation? How about a religious conversion, where you're unable to reflect legitimately on the transformation by its very nature? I just leave these thoughts to your mind. Like I said, more questions, no answers. Consider now more transformations, which indeed we did not choose. Some are part of the normal course of human life and the uncertain nature of the future. Others result from the fact that we cannot control the choices others can make, but that affect us. So, disease, aging, physical accidents, unplanned pregnancy or parenting, economic shifts as when jobs or careers disappear out from under us, family ostracism as a result of unchangeable features about us or the choices we make. These are major transformations when they happen to us, and they're things that we really don't have much say in choosing. But the very same difficulties with knowing, or epistemic difficulties, may apply to unchosen transformations. Even as they are happening to us, we cannot know what they will bring. And it might be good, right? It might be fine, even if it's not good, right? So consider the so-called disability paradox. When asked to rate quality of life, very many people without significant disabilities say they are generally satisfied, with a majority saying they have excellent or good quality of life. Yet most people who are born with significant disabilities rate their satisfaction with life at the same level as people who are born without them. And after a period of adjustment, most people who acquire significant disabilities again report general satisfaction with their lives. Many will say, oh, I wish I hadn't been paralyzed from the waist down, but they'll still, if asked, like, do you enjoy your life? Is it good or excellent? Many of them will say yes. In fact, 54.3% of people with moderate to severe disabilities report having an excellent or good quality of life, and a large portion of the other folks with those disabilities report having a satisfactory quality of life, one they can live with, right? And yet studies show that if you ask persons without disabilities about what their lives would be like after disability, they say it would be a low quality of life, right? So you ask able-bodied people, what would it be like if you became paralyzed? And they say, oh, it would be horrible. I could never have a good life after that. The tricky thing about this for philosophers, and for me as a medical ethicist, is that some then go on to characterize a life after disability as not worth living while they're able-bodied. And then they make judgments about refusing life-sustaining care on that basis. So there was a gentleman who was a hunter who was badly injured in a hunting accident last year. and asked for life support to be turned off when he found out he was going to be paralyzed from the waist down, and he died. Yet the vast majority of people who have these kinds of significant disabilities, after a period of adjustment, come to rate their lives as at least satisfactory, and more than half of them as good or excellent quality of life. This is called the disability paradox. So becoming disabled is a transformative experience, like the ones that Laurie Paul describes. It's straightforwardly unknowable in advance. And even if we can say, hey, folks who have disabilities, significant disabilities, are your lives pretty good by your judgment? And they say yes, we still can't know for sure if we'll be one of those people. Right. You can ask others, but you can't know for yourself. And our considered judgments about it are often incorrect, as evidenced by the fact that most able-bodied people say they could never live like that. While disability may come upon us not by choice, our choices to accept or refuse medical treatment are at least potentially within our own power, right? And this mix of chosen and unchosen, where you have unchosen circumstances and chosen responses, raises similar issues to those straightforwardly chosen things that Laurie Paul was talking about. Do we become a vampire, right? Or do we have children? Do we take a new job? Do we move to a new place? Right? So when we become pregnant or a parent not by choice, when we become diseased, when we age, when we have a physical accident, when we experience economic shifts that lead our jobs or careers to disappear out from under us, all these are transformations whose characters we cannot know in advance. Our responses are all we control, but when we make those responses on the assumption that we can know the character of the transformations, we go badly wrong. So we've got to be pretty skeptical about this if we're going to be straightforwardly honest with ourselves, right? But there's another set of really useful concepts here that I'm not going to talk about nearly as much that might be helpful to you in your thinking. That's the notion of a positive good and a negative good, and that sounds odd, right? How could something be negatively good? Well, a positive good is when you seek out something that adds to your life. A negative good is when you seek out the absence of something that's bad. So a classic example of this is if you are trapped in a burning building and there is no way out, and you had the ability to end your life earlier than the fire would kill you, death would be a negative good because it would be the absence of burning to death. All right. And so this is a thing that's usually used with when talking about physician-assisted suicide for terminally ill patients, where death and earlier death is often seen as a negative good by the people who choose it. So a negative good or a positive good, when we seek out a transformative experience, is it to leave a terrible situation because anything must be better than this, that's a negative good. If we seek out a transformation and it's to find something even better that we want to actively have in our lives, that's a positive good. So many of us long for transformation not because of what it will bring, but because of what it will take us away from, pain and suffering, right? That's the negative good idea. So while I've spent far less time discussing these concepts than issues with radically transformative experiences, I suggest these two simple concepts of why we might seek transformation could really be very useful. So what does transformation mean to you? What transformations have you undergone? How sure are we, after a transformation which we find to have been good, that it is indeed good, as opposed to being a transformation that by its nature requires us to commit to it having been a good idea? Can we tell when a transformation brings peril or promise? Do they bring both? Is your own longing for particular transformations driven by a desire for transformation as a negative good, a longing to escape anything that may be better than this? Or is it driven by a desire for transformation as a positive good to acquire a particular kind of self? Only you can say, guru. Only you can say.